Burke said the captain wants you and the other section chiefs down the orderly room tent right away, he said. I guess you know why. Well, hey, my friends, how are you? This is Keith Tyler bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sunsounds of Arizona. Real treat to have you with me. The Playboy Book of Crime and Suspense and Fred McMurrow bring us our first story, and it's called With All Due Respect. Sergeant Gagliano stood between the trails of the howitzers, bellowing out the commands he was getting over the telephone headset from the executive officer. Shell H.E. VT Fuse 3-9-4. Number 6 man kneed the fat projectile upright, and number 5 expertly screwed the variable time fuse on its nose to the setting of 3-9-4. Charge 7! Numbers 4 and 3 slapped 7 bags of powder into the casing. 6, 5, 4, and 3 placed the loading tray under the gaping maw of the breech, put the shell on the tray, and heaved it home with a rammer staff. Corporal Billings swung the breech closed. Base deflection, left 2-9-0. Number 2 man whirled his wheel, and the snout of the howitzer turned gently toward the northwest, where, over the lip of the rise, lay the German lines, only 1,000 yards away. Elevation 8-5. Billings spun the wheel on his side of the breech, and number 4 gun rose like an anaconda spotting its prey. Billings locked the setting, turned to face the sergeant, and picked up the firing pin lanyard. Fire! And number 4 gun thundered and recoiled with the grace of a great snake, and the earth shivered under Gagliano's feet. He breathed deeply, his nostrils stung by the sweet, biting smoke. The earth quivered again under him, but much more gently, as Charlie Battery's shells went to earth in the German lines. That did it, men. That did it, came the executive officer's voice in his ear and those of the other 3 gun sergeants. Infantry says it turned them back, what was left of them. 6 Tiger Tank men. The colonel sends you his compliments. Mission accomplished. Gagliano took off the headset and dropped it at his feet. The crew, all still in position for another round, was looking at him expectantly. Eh, the colonel says you couldn't hit an old lady crossing the street, men, Gagliano said. He's coming down here and he's going to show you 8-balls how to handle a gun. What was it anyway? Corporal Billings said. Tiger tanks again, Gagliano said. Over across from Loyano. They were trying to bust up the 36th heavy weapons. We stopped them. Relax, men. Rest. Smoke if you like. It was such a tired old joke, but they loved him, and they laughed anyway. All but Billings set to work, opening the breech of their gigantic child and swabbing out its hot throat with the solvent liquid. The phone jangled. Billings picked up the headset. Number 4, Billings said. Hi, Ray. Oh, okay. You'll be right down. He dropped the headset and stepped close to Gagliano. Burke says the captain wants you and the other section chiefs down the orderly room tent right away, he said. I guess you know why? Gagliano shrugged hopelessly. Yeah, I know why, he said. Nobody on the crew knows about it, do they? You didn't tell none of them, men? Oh, heck no, Billings said. I figured you'd tell them yourself if you wanted them to know. Yeah, Gagliano said. Well, I guess it had to happen sometime. Listen, make sure that breech is clean, will you? I don't want no more hang fires this week. As he trudged away, He smiled at himself, reminding Billings about cleaning the gun when that wouldn't be his responsibility any longer. The other section chiefs were already there. They were all big men, as Gagliano was. At his desk sat Ray Burke, the tough little lantern-jawed man who was their first sergeant. "Hi, Gag," Burke said, toying with a pencil. "All right, you men form up a line in front of me. Dress on the right." "What is this? Are we going to pass in review or something?" Gagliano said. Burke sighed. "You've been in the army long enough to know what this is," he said. "You know how he is. He wants it real red hot, like the 4th of July, or 10 hut!" And the captain stumped in, his head passing under the section chief's chests, his crisply pressed ODs ballooning about his thin little legs, his mousy face hidden under the burnished, battered steel helmet. He put the helmet on the desk and faced them. "I think all you men know what's going to happen here," he said. He nodded at Gagliano. "All right, you, one step forward, march!" The giant clopped one step out of line and snapped his heels together. The captain folded his arms and looked at each one of them, savoring every second of the moment. Then he pointed at Gagliano. "Gagliano," he announced in his high-pitched, squeaky voice, "as far as I'm concerned, your appointment as a sergeant has terminated." "You motherless little crud," Gagliano thought. "You haven't called me sergeant since we got you, and you wouldn't do it even when you were busting me. You must have sat up all night just thinking how to say it. Well, I never called you sir either, just captain." "I hope the rest of you men realize what this means," the captain said. For effect, he put his hands behind him and strutted solemnly to the tent door and gazed out at the titanic upward sweep of the Monte Cattini Alto and its neighboring peaks, which looked like an angry stone ocean when you were on top of one. The captain whirled around. "Now, if there's a man here that don't like it, let him tell me so straight to my face." The only returned his stare, each one expressionless. "This damn man here has been a bone of contention in my craw since I took over this outfit," the captain said. "He don't want to toe the mark. He don't think I know how to handle soldiers. He wants to wipe their noses for them. He don't deserve to wear a gun sergeant's stripes. Sergeant Burke, I want you to read off the charges against this man here." Burke cleared his throat. "Captain, sir," he said, "with all due respect, sir, I just posted all them charges on the bulletin board, and I don't see, Sergeant Burke, where the first sergeant gets off putting no interpretation on my orders," the captain said. It's not that, sir," Burke said. "Well, then what is it? Maybe you don't think I should bust a man if I think he should be busted. Maybe you think I ought to ask you first. Is that it, Sergeant?" Burke gave in. "All right, sir," he said, and took one of the quadruplicates from his 2-battalion box. "Dereliction of duty, insubordination, failure to observe military courtesy, appropriation of a military vehicle for unauthorized uses, fraternization with the enemy." What's that?" Gagliano said. "What's that last one?" "You will remain at attention, soldier," the captain said. "Captain, sir," Burke said, "the ARs say a man has a right to hear all the charges against him." The captain glared at Burke, helpless rage all over his face. He couldn't bust Burke, and he knew it. They all respected Burke too much, and the captain knew they did not respect him. "All right, Sergeant," the captain said. He stepped up to Gagliano and glared up at the big face above him. "You know darn well what I mean by fraternizing with the enemy," he said. A flush crept up Gagliano's thick neck. "If I might have permission to speak, Captain," he said. "I told you to remain at attention." "If I had permission to speak, damn it, what the hell do you mean by the enemy?"
"I mean them Dago horrors we caught you with last night when you took the weapons carrier out," the captain said. "Is that so hard to understand?"
"Just because I was with some Italian girls, I was fraternizing with the enemy?"
"That's right," the captain said. "I never seen a Dago yet I could trust, and I'm sure General Truscott don't either."
"That's a lie, Captain," Gagliano said.
"Go ahead," the captain said. "Speak your piece. It'll sound good when I take this to a higher court-martial."
"The Italian people been on our side for a long time now, Captain," Gagliano said. "And if you call that fraternizing with the enemy, me spending a nice sociable evening with a couple of girls and their mothers, Captain?"
"A bunch of whores," the captain said. "What decent girl would go out with some bum soldier who just stole some government property?"
"I admit that, Captain," Gagliano said. "If you're busting me for taking the weapons carrier, I admit I took it with no authorization. But the enemy is them Jerries, not the Italian people."
"Captain, sir," Burke said. "A word in private, sir."
They stepped outside into the blasting Italian sunlight.
"With all due respect, Captain," Burke said, "you can't make that charge stick, and it'll only look bad if you try, sir. I know the colonel won't like it."
"Sergeant Burke," the captain said, "if I didn't need you like I need my two hands here, I'd rip the stripes off your arm. Are you going to stand in my way here, too, or are you going to help me do my job and make soldiers out of this bunch of eight balls?"
"With all due respect, sir," Burke said, showing no reaction at all. "Any punk second lieutenant could knock the props right out from under a dumbbell charge like that if he was Gagliano's counsel, sir. If I might speak right out, sir?"
"Well?"
"Thank you, sir. With all due respect, sir, I'm just trying to save you from looking like a horse's butt." The captain looked as if Burke had slapped him.
"All right, Sergeant," he said. "Eliminate that charge against him. But I want the whole busting order typed over again, all five copies, including the one on the bulletin board there. Rip it off."
"Yes, sir," said Burke, ripping it off the board and crumpling it. "It's all right. Battalion don't know anything about the case yet, sir. I hope the captain won't take what I say personally, sir. It's my job as the first sergeant to advise."
"Don't you tell me the duties of a first sergeant," the captain snapped. "Don't you think I know what a first sergeant's supposed to do?"
"Yes, sir," Burke said. "I know you got a tough job here. I just want to help you win the confidence and respect of the men, sir. You got to remember, Captain, these men been together since this was a National Guard outfit back in 39. You don't want to create no more problems than you already got, sir. I hope the captain understands me."
"You just understand me," the captain said. "If I have to, I'll bust every darn non-com, including the mess sergeant. I'm going to make this a fighting military outfit, Sergeant. Just remember that."
"Yes, sir," Burke said. They stepped back inside. "Captain," said Burke, at his desk again, "will Private Gagliano stay on number 4 crew, or do you want him on one of the other guns?" The captain smiled.
"I don't want that man on the guns at all," he said. "You will assign him to the ammo detail. I see by his MOS he's a truck driver as well as a cannoneer. All right. He can drive with the ammo detail and help with the loading. He's got a good strong back if he ain't got a brain in that Dago head of his."
"Will that be a permanent duty or battery punishment, sir?"
"No, that's permanent duty," the captain said. "The ammo detail, the pinhead squad."
The phone buzzed and Burke picked it up. "Charlie Battery," he said.
"Good afternoon, sir."
"Yes, he's here."
"For you, Captain."
"Captain Barker here,"
the captain said. Oh, yes, Colonel. Yes, sir. Everything's just fine around here. Just fine.
Getting along?
I'm getting along just fine, sir.
Of course, we're ready for a new fire mission, sir.
Oh?
Oh, yes, sir.
Yes, I've seen that on the map.
No, we won't need any extra time, sir.
1600?
That'll be fine, sir. Yes, sir.
Yes, indeed, sir.
He handed the phone back to Burke.
There's a big fire mission starting at 1600, he said. The 36th is moving up, and we're in support. The colonel said we can expect to keep each gun firing steadily until 2400. You section chiefs, he noted with satisfaction that Gagliano became unconsciously attentive. Can you do it?
We'll do it, said Sergeant Eaves, a section chief of number one gun. We've been doing it since El Guitar, Captain.
That went home to the captain, that mention of the North African campaign, of a time when he wasn't even in the army.
Well, now, I don't know, the captain said. That's a lot of firing. I don't know if we've got enough ammo.
Oh, there's plenty of reserve ammo, Burke said. We brought in 3 new loads from Bassano this morning.
I'll make that decision, Sergeant Burke, the captain said. And my decision is that we'll go back with the trucks now, and I will go along. I want to see Gagliano in action.
Yes, sir, Burke said. I'll call battalion and have the runners bring the jeep back.
No, no, don't bother, the captain said. I'll ride in the trucks. In fact, I'll drive one of the trucks.
The section chiefs looked at each other.
Captain, sir, the Sergeant Dudley, section chief of number 2 gun, said.
Them prime movers are an awful handful of truck for anybody but an experienced driver, especially out on Highway 65, sir. It's a lousy road. It's banked the wrong way on the turns. Now, I'll be doggone, the captain said. Here's a man in this battery who's a little concerned about his captain.
Well, ain't that nice.
Don't you think I know how to handle an artillery truck, Sergeant?
Yes, sir, said Dudley.
Well, then keep your mouth shut, the captain said.
Before we get started, there's a little ceremony I've been saving up for this moment.
He stepped up to Gagliano and ripped the sergeant's stripes off the giant's arms. The captain peered at the dark patch on the faded left sleeve where the stripes had been.
Well, my, my, he said, they've been there a long time.
Yes, they have, Captain, Gagliano said, since 39.
Well, you'll never wear them again as long as I'm around, the captain said. All right, now you sergeants go out and get your cannoneers ready for the ammo detail.
Cannoneers? Burke said. Captain, them cannoneers done 3 firing missions already today, and they're going to be firing all night, too. They going to need their strength, Captain.
Are they men or little boys who got to have their bottle, Sergeant?
The captain said.
They're cannoneers, sir, Burke said.
And with all due respect, sir, them are the best darn cannoneers in the army, but they ain't machines, sir.
You know, Sergeant, the captain said,
this is a war we got on our hands here, and sometimes we got to expend a little extra effort. We got to show the men they got to respect us.
Yes, sir, Burke said.
But when your guns are in position, you save the cannoneers for the firing, and you use the other men for the ammo detail, sir.
The telephone linemen and the radio section and the machine gunners, sir. That's who you use on the ammo detail. What kind of fairies I got here anyway, the captain said. You, Sergeant, afraid to make your men do a little work?
Burke sighed.
All right, sir, he said. We'll use the cannoneers.
You're darn right we'll use the cannoneers, the captain said. I'll be down in the motor pool waiting for you.
He left the tent, and they watched him until he was out of sight, beyond the ruin of the old German anti-aircraft position.
I'm sorry, Gag, Berg said.
The giant shrugged.
It's all right, he said. I can't soldier under a man like that anyway.
No, I mean the stuff he was saying about Italians, Burke said.
He
He shouldn't talk that way to any man.
I'll tell you something else he shouldn't, Dudley said. He shouldn't be in charge of no men. I wouldn't have a monkey lover like that in charge of a latrine detail. He'd make you salute it before you buried it.
By damn, the Sergeant Hansen, section chief of number 3 gun, I've seen this man's army do some pretty darn dumb things, but when they made that red hot a captain, they started from the beginning again. What's the matter with the colonel, anyway, giving us a dope like that?
Don't blame the colonel, Burke said. He couldn't help himself. You remember how it was when Captain Garver got it? Them 24-hour fire missions, with Jerry busting out all over the 36th line like an old pair of pants splitting? Well, shoot, the colonel couldn't shift none of his officers around. He did all he could do. He asked Naples for a replacement.
So we get a rear echelon commando from the Repel-Depel, Eve said, and spat on the floor.
I never forgot that first day, Burke said. He says to me in that squeaky little voice of his,
Sergeant, I want you to get me the beat-uppest old steel helmet you can find around here.
So I got it for him, and you know what he's done? He sat up in his tent half the night hitting the helmet with a hammer. It wasn't beat up enough for him. And then he polishes it. Boy, what a red hot.
Where was he before he came to us, Ray? Hansen asked.
Just in the officer's pool at the Repel-Depel, Burke said. He was there 6 months, and before that he was a cadre at Fort Bragg. That's why he's such a red hot, I guess. Back in the States, all he had to do was push dumb recruits around, and they put him in an outfit like this with real soldiers. He don't know how to handle them. He don't understand why we ain't out policing up the area every morning. He misses the bugles.
Here's the bugle, right here, Gagliano said.
Listen, Ray, who are you going to make?
For your section, Billings, Burke said.
Good, Gagliano said. He'll be a good sergeant. They're used to listening to him. I was afraid the captain would try to put somebody on who wasn't in the crew.
Not while I'm the first sergeant, Burke said. I know what he's up to.
Just what the heck is that crazy man up to? Gagliano said.
You gotta be first sergeant to spot it early, Burke said. He figures that the way the battery is now, it's a bunch of little cliques all working against him. What he wants to do is go right down the line, busting the non-coms and splitting up all the crews so they aren't with guys they've been with for years. He figures that'll make it easier for him.
He wants the stripes of yours awful bad, Ray, said Hansen. I seen him looking at that first sergeant's diamond on your arm like it was a bare-butt woman.
Yeah, I know it, Burke said. I know it better than any of you guys. I seen it that first day when he busted Johnson right in front of all the men and ripped the stripes off his arm.
He'll never do that again, said Gagliano.
He done it to you, didn't he? Dudley said. He done it right here 5 minutes ago.
Well, that was just among us sergeants, Gagliano said.
He would have done it in front of the formation if Johnson hadn't jumped him that time. And me, big stupid me, I had to be Joe Noble and pull old Red off of him.
And what if you let him kill the captain? Burke said. You would have been in command of a firing squad the next morning.
Nope, you done the right thing.
Where's old Red now? Eve said.
The last I heard, he was in the discipline battalion near Naples, Burke said.
Oh, I heard about that place, Eve said.
They sleep in shelter halves with one blanket all year, Burke said. They get one pair of fatigues and one razor blade, and they got to use that razor blade for a month, and they got to shave twice a day.
A guy in the 36th told me about it, Eve said. When he got out of there, he was glad to be back in the line. He said three guys died there last winter.
Yep, Burke said. Well, let's get this over with. Go on, get the poor motherless cannoneers.
At the motor pool, the captain was looking at its watch.
"Sergeant Burke, you know how long I've been waiting here," he bellowed.
Sorry, sir," Burke said. "Some of the cannoneers was asleep."
"You just by damn better be sorry," the captain said.
The 40 men from the gun crews stood silent, watching Burke take it. The captain turned to them.
"Your sergeants, who've been wiping your little noses all these years, well, they don't think you ought to be going on no ammo details," he said.
"Well, I think different, and I'm the captain. Anybody want to dispute that? Any SOB want to differ with me?" They just stood, looking at him.
"I've been your commanding officer 3 weeks since Captain Garver was killed," he said. "Now, I don't know how he held this outfit together, because when I took command, you were a bunch of Boy Scouts. You didn't know nothing about military courtesy, and you didn't have no discipline, and you still don't. Oh, I know what you think of me. I ain't National Guard, so I stink. I ain't a member of the club. Well, gentlemen, you're going to respect me or I'll die making you do it. It's going to be one of us, gentlemen, you or me, and by golly, it's not going to be me. Now let's mount up on these trucks here and get some work done."
"Captain, sir," said one of the cannoneers. The captain peered at him.
"You're Private Zakian, ain't you?"
"Yes, sir," the cannoneer said. "Captain, sir, when you said son of a gun, who did you mean?" The captain smiled. He had his outburst, and he felt genial now.
"Well, I meant myself, son," he said, "because I'm one."
"Well, that's good, Captain," said the cannoneer, "because I'm not." The laughter rolled over him like an ocean breaker.
"Put that man on report for 7 days extra duty," the captain shrieked at Burke.
After some coaxing, the captain agreed to let one of the regular drivers sit with him in the cab. The trucks were tall, ugly 7-tonners, like buildings with wheels on them. They had the tremendous power necessary to jockey the great 8-inch guns around. And there was a lot the drivers had to know. At the ammunition dump, the captain perched himself on the fender of his truck, his shiny boots bouncing off the big fat tire, shouting abuse at the silent, sweating cannoneers as they wrestled the shells up into the truck tailgates. An 8-inch howitzer projectile weighed 200 pounds. It was 3 hours before the trucks were loaded to capacity. Burke took the captain aside.
"With all due respect, sir," he said, "I think you better let the driver handle the truck on the way back."
"I'll drive," the captain said.
"Captain, sir," Burke said, "you don't know what it's like pushing one of these things over the mountain with a load of HE.
"I said, I'll drive," the captain said.
"But you'll have the men riding with you, sir. Suppose there's an accident, sir." "With all due respect, sir, I don't think you should take the responsibility."
"Is that the way you talk to Captain Garver?" the captain said. "Did you tell him his business, too? Did he need his nose wiped like the rest of those NGs there?"
Burke felt himself breathing hard.
"Listen, Sergeant Burke," the captain said. "I'm trying to set an example to these men here. I'm going to drive that damn truck, and what's more, I'm going to do it alone."
"You mean you don't want the driver with you?" Burke said, controlling himself with a terrible effort.
"That's right. I'm going to be up there in that little old cab all by myself."
"All right, you crazy bastard," Burke said, "but I'll tell you one thing you're not going to do. If you take that wheel, you're going to have that truck all to yourself. I'm not going to let any of my men ride with you."
"Your men, Sergeant?"
"Yeah, my men," Burke said. "Listen, you're never going to run this outfit because you don't deserve to be no officer. You can go to hell, and I hope you do."
"Oh, I'm going to enjoy this," the captain said. "I've been waiting for you to hang yourself. You know what you just done, don't you? You just busted yourself."
"Yeah, I know,"
Burke said. And if I look at that dumb bastard face of yours another second, I'm going to bust it.
Burke stepped into the road and addressed the convoy.
All you men riding on Captain Barker's truck, he called. You get off there and ride on the other trucks. The driver, too. Taylor, you go ride with Eves. Captain, you want lead the convoy?
Oh, no, said the captain. Let Gagliano lead. I'll be right behind him. I want to keep an eye on that boy.
Burke waited until all the men were mounted up. Then he climbed up beside Gagliano, leaned out, and waved his fist in a circle. The engines bellowed to life. Gagliano let the clutch out and led the lurching behemoth over the bumpy driveway of the ammo dump to Highway 65. Burke sat and stared silently at the countryside going by. Gagliano sat back, relaxed, only one hand on the wheel, as if he were tooling a convertible down a parkway. His own great bulk matched the truck's perfectly. He noticed that Burke was silent.
Hey, what's the matter, Ray?
Move over, Burke said. Make room for a private.
What the heck are you talking about? I mean, I couldn't take it no more, Burke said. I mean, I blew my stack at that bastard and now I'm going to get busted.
Now, what's the sense in that?
Who knows what the sense, Burke said. The heck with it.
He can't do that to you, Gagliano said.
Can't he?
They were approaching the rise of the Monte Catini Alto. Gagliano's great paw grabbed the gear shift almost viciously, and his left big foot thundered on the steel floor of the cab as he double-clutched the truck down into a more powerful gear for the climb.
Listen, Ray, he said, you mean he's really going to bust the first sergeant?
Yeah, he's going to bust the first sergeant, Burke said. Doesn't matter. I can't soldier under that guy neither.
On the curve, Gagliano looked in his side-view mirror and saw the captain hugging the wheel, his little head barely coming over the windshield.
If he busts the first sergeant, this outfit won't be worth a hill of crud anymore, Gagliano said.
I know. The men won't be no good.
I know. You're the only guy who's holding us all together now.
Yeah, sure.
They were near the top of the rise. Far to the west, Burke saw the British 240 batteries firing, tiny puffs of white issuing from their mouths, and then seconds later in the German territory below, the sudden bloom of the burst, the fat black smoke that seemed to sit on the earth like a tumbleweed.
Gagliano's eyes narrowed. He geared down to third, and the truck nearly crawled to a stop.
He ain't gonna bust you, Ray.
No, of course not, said Burke. And there ain't gonna be no all-night fire mission, and Jerry ain't gonna fight no more, 'cause he's gonna come in the orderly room and say, Burke, I surrender, and we're all gonna go home. Sure.
The captain's horn honked irritably, right behind them.
All right, you, Gagliano said. He let the clutch out, and the truck tilted its flat snout and began to descend the mountain.
Burke, he said, just suppose this captain had to have a replacement. Who would we get?
Burke thought for a moment.
Well, we'd get our old exec, Lieutenant Tumpani, he said. From the colonel's staff, he's the S3 now.
Look, knock it off, will you, Gag? Bastards like this never get killed.
The truck was gathering speed, impelled by the tonnage of high explosives.
You know, Gagliano said, I done a lot of crazy jobs when I was a civilian. I ever tell you about that?
What, how you was a wrestler? How you was a longshoreman? How you was a lumberjack?
Sure, Burke said.
Well, back in 36... I was in the lumber camps, Gagliano said. They give me a job driving a truck hauling one of them big trailers where the logs are held together by chains.
Burke noticed their speed, but he didn't mention it. He knew Gag was a heck of a driver, and he trusted him.
"You think it's bad with Jerry shooting at us," Gagliano said. "You should ride one of them log trucks. Man, you pucker up all over. The camp was up in the mountains, and we hauled the logs down a road just like this, into town." "Watch the speed, Gag," Burke said. "I seen a couple of guys who got into accidents," Gagliano said. "You know what them logs did? The chains couldn't hold them. They just smashed right into the cab and squashed them guys as flat as a hamburger." "Hey, Gag, for goodness sake, take it easy," Burke said. "One day there, I told the boss my brakes was gone, and you know what he said? He said, 'Fine, then you'll just get there all the faster.' And he gave me a $50 bonus. Well, you remember what it was like in 36. You'd do a lot more than that for $50. Gag, slow down." In the side mirror, Gagliano saw that the captain was right on his tail, but the other trucks were still far up the mountain, making a slow, cautious descent. Now their truck was lurching like a toy being flipped by a giant hand. "You really learned to handle a truck on them mountains," Gagliano said. Burke gritted his teeth and braced his feet against the firewall. Ahead of them was a sharp turn, at whose apex was nothing. Nothing but the map of North Italy, the little farms making a crazy quilt pattern of color. "Now you take a turn like that down there," Gagliano said. "With a load in back of you, a good driver, well, he'll know just how to handle it." And swiftly he geared the hurtling monster down to more power and gunned the truck for all it was worth as they entered the turn. The engine snarled as if it were alive, and the truck yawed sickeningly, but the increased speed made the tires bite surely into the pavement, and 100 yards beyond the curve, Gagliano's hands and feet flew again, and the truck shuddered to a stop. He sat back and listened, a dreamy smile on his face. Burke opened his eyes. Seconds went by, and then, far, far below them, they heard an explosion that sounded like all the guns on the front firing at once. "Now a driver who don't know nothing," Gagliano said, "on a turn like that, he loses his head and listens to his impulses, and his impulses say step on the brake, and when he does that, he just keeps going straight ahead, see?" The other trucks pulled up behind them. The men swarmed off and ran to peer over the cliff. "Like I said, Sergeant Burke," said Gagliano, "it really takes a heck of a driver to handle a mountain." "Like you said, Sergeant Gagliano," Burke said, "with all due respect." All right, plunging ahead into the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, a story by Angelique Fawns. It's called Detective Ellie Stone's Nutty Halloween Murder Mystery. Crime stats always go up on Halloween night. Vandalism, drunk driving, and assaults all skyrocket. Every Toronto cop knows it. That's why I was thrilled to get the night off so I could trick-or-treat with my daughter. Our sleepy West End subdivision was a low-crime area and a great place for collecting high-end candy. Lenore tugged on my black witch's gown. "Can I have another piece of Mrs. Harriet's walnut cake? It's so yummy!" Her 10-year-old face was covered in sticky brown crumbs. I licked my finger to wipe them off her cheeks. "Do you need more sugar right before trick-or-treatings?" "Yes!" she hopped around me, clapping her hands. "No," I grinned.
Go get your costume on.
When Lenore disappeared into her bedroom, I snagged a piece of the gooey dessert. The aroma of chocolate was irresistible. Closing my eyes, I relished the taste of sugar, walnut, and cocoa. Every few years, Harriet Henderson's massive walnut tree dropped nuts like blood from a butcher's block. It was a bit of a pain for the street, the little black balls littering the neighbor's lawns and sidewalk like mutant bunny turds. Even worse was the toxic juglone leaking from the shells and wilting the other plants. But her generous habit of sharing her baking more than made up for it. Harriet was in her early 70s and loved Halloween. Every year she outdid herself with festive decorations. Jack-o'-lanterns crowded on the porch. Ghosts swung from the branches of her trees, and an enormous zombie stood guard by her front door. As the pièce de résistance, she set her speakers blaring creepy music and a light show that lit up the front of her house. Lenore danced back into the living room, transformed into the world's cutest unicorn. She pressed her nose to the living room. "Mom, why isn't Mrs. Henderson's house all lit up?" Her pink horn quivered at the top of her fluffy white costume. I glanced over, and my stomach sank like a coffin. It didn't take my detective badge to know that if Harriet's bungalow was dark on Halloween, something was wrong. Next door, Frank Furman had his usual single pumpkin on the front step, with his porch light illuminating a take-what-you-want bowl of gross orange toffees. He would never mar his struggling rose garden with decor. "I don't know, honey." I grabbed my witching broom and a tactical flashlight and gave Lenore's tail a tug. "Hey, get your dad to take you trick-or-treating." "Mom, no!" Lenore pouted and headed up to her father's den to pull him away from the hockey game. Dan would be mildly irritated, but eating a few of Lenore's chocolate treats at the end of the night would sweeten him up. He was accustomed to stepping in when duty called me away from the family. Shivering against the chilly fall air, I crossed the road to Harriet's walkway. Black walnuts rolled under my curled-toed boots, almost knocking me off balance. With a gasp, I caught myself on a ghost hanging from the thick branch. There was a dim flickering coming from a basement window, and I wondered if her son had been released from jail. Billy had been caught selling illegal vapes and sent to Toronto South Detention Center. His room was in the basement, and before his sentence he'd lurked there like a hibernating bear. Using my broom, I swept through the nuts to the porch. A life-sized zombie watched me solemnly. "Harriet, Ellie Stone here." Flicking on my flashlight, I opened the front door. Harriet sat in the hallway, but judging by her purple face, her days of handing out treats were over. She was tied to her heavy oak chair with yellow rope. I checked her pulse. Nothing. Acid rose up my throat. Harriet was dead. I leaned to take a closer look at the poor woman, wondering why her mouth gaped open. Squinting, I saw a walnut wedged up between her tonsils and forcing her jaw open. I fought the urge to pop it out. Don't touch the corpse. The base of my spine tingled. Who would tie an old lady to a chair and then forcefully shove a walnut down her throat? I imagined her last moments, struggling against her binds as she fought for breath. There were black smudges on her neck, round stains that looked like finger marks. My guts twisted like mating snakes when I saw the dark stain on her polyester pants. She'd soiled herself, and the tang of urine mixed with terror sweat. This felt very personal. I pulled out my cell phone to call in the crime and sent a text to my husband to keep a close eye on Lenore. Then I clenched my flashlight. I'd mourn my beautiful neighbor later. The killer
might be close by. After a quick scan of the bungalow's main floor, which was clear, I left my broom by the front door and made my way to the basement. As I cautiously made my way down the uneven wooden steps, the smell of weed and dirty socks seared my nose.
"Billy, you down here?"
In the haze of skunky smoke, Billy was hunched over a game of Plants versus Zombies. I poked him with my broom. He blinked like a vampire caught in the sunlight as he removed one earphone. His pupils were dilated. "You've been released early, Billy," I asked him, fairly sure he was stoned into immobility on weed, not the usual drug of choice for violent activity. As cops, we always joked that once Canada legalized marijuana, violent crime went down in Toronto.
"Week pass," he grunted, rubbing his red eyes. He was so stoned that he didn't even bother to ask why his cop neighbor was in his basement, dressed like a witch. Oh, poor Harriet had cried a few times over tea with me about her wayward son, though that didn't stop her from baking special walnut brownies. Billy's slumped posture hinted that he'd eaten a few of those.
"Did you fight with your mother?"
"No, man, I've been playing all day."
He slipped his earphones back on and turned to his game. My instinct told me Billy wasn't the murderer. I doubted he had the motivation to walk up the stairs, much less tie up his mother and shove a walnut down her throat. I bit my lip and thought about telling him about his mother's death, then decided that the news could wait. I didn't have time to deal with a devastated drug-addled convict. Someone had murdered Harriet, and I needed to figure out who it was. My own daughter was out there. Looking over his shoulder, I saw Billy's video game score was high enough to suggest he'd been at the computer for hours. His fingers twitched as a catapult zombie blew up a garden. The son wasn't the killer, but maybe there was a hint here. No one liked their garden destroyed, like Frank Furman and his rose garden. Pulling my dress up to my knees, I navigated the uneven stairs and grabbed my broom on the way out the door. I kept the broom in front of me and, like a curler, swept a path to Frank's house. The walnuts rolled like a dwarf-sized bowling balls. His jack-o'-lantern leered at me with candle-lit eyes. The octogenarian opened his door with a scowl.
"You're a bit old for trick-or-treat, ain't you, Ellie?"
His fingers and palms were stained black, as if he'd been handling walnuts. The residue from those nuts was impossible to wash off.
"Why'd you do it, Frank?" I asked. "Harriet never meant anyone any harm."
"Yeah, tell that to my rose garden. Them black walnuts leak poison from the roots and hulls."
He scratched his bald head, leaving a smudge on his temple.
"Did she do anything about it?"
"No."
"I've got to bring you in." I pointed the tip of my broom at his sunken chest. Frank threw a bag of Tootsie Rolls at my head and tottered off his porch. He didn't get far before he lost his balance on a nut and fell to the ground, knocked out cold. I removed my costume's belt and tied his hands behind his back. Then I checked his pulse. It was strong. He'd be fine.
I muttered to the back of his wrinkled head, "Maybe you should have eaten some of Harriet's special walnut brownies, you old foul old man." While waiting for my co-workers to arrive, I plugged in Harriet's Halloween display. Green lights lit up the ghosts in her tree and shone eerily on the porch zombie. I bowed my head and said goodbye. My old friend had loved Halloween and wouldn't want her hours of decorating to go to waste. So much for the crime statistic in our neighborhood staying low. This Halloween was turning out even nuttier than normal. I was going to miss Harriet and her walnut cake. ¶¶
Okay, staying in the same Ellery Queen mystery magazine, we have just a few minutes left. I'm going to read you a poem. It's called Noir Notes by Neil McRoberts for Gareth Hughes. And there's a editor's note here. The poet tells Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, "This poem was written in honor of a departed friend who was a true fan and devotee of crime fiction, particularly noir and jazz. It's an evocation of a conceptual world that he loved. Readers may enjoy the puzzle of identifying the various characters who appear, some obvious, some less so." How can I go back to somewhere I've never been? Night in some city, fictional metropolis, a somewhere that place and time elide. Future now, present past, facades change, themes remain. Baldwin's here, heart aflame, listening, loving, with the struggle, good trouble, as Bill unlocks his soul, key by key at the vanguard, or LaFaro flares, brilliant vibration, a brief spark flying to forever, alive in the glowing dark. Happily homesick, a nocturnal nostalgia, the phosphorescent canyons, scattered rubies and diamonds, neon and brake lights caught in the rain. Modal heart sliding, not falling or climbing, but nonetheless moving the soul in transit to some other place. Trying like Philip or easy to answer, the insistent, so what? Vamping on the beat to catch the plot of his life. While the carefree soloist improvise, I'm reminded by heartbreak, blue in green kills me. That I need to find Neff before he finds his. Put an end to his schemes with sad Mrs. Dietrichson. Built in serendipity, a Fog City bar, I run into Jacoby. He detains me, while Desmond or Getz mirror slick streets, playing their coolness out of their time. Disguise our soft voices, and, as the captain unburdens himself, of the weight of his secrets, the low lights scatter amber from thick bourbon glasses as we talk of the sea. I persuade him, leaving, looking over his shoulder, to turn down to the harbor, take La Paloma back to the ocean. Sam's heart spared that terrible sorrow. The fat man can wait for the bird in his hand. I step into wet air, go looking for Walter. I know the diner where he eats, a Reuben. Drinks black coffee late in the evening, while Herbie fills spaces. In the Nighthawk's small hours, rattle of plates and lost lives, I'll suggest the Mojave, a maiden voyage. Just me. And G, brother in crime, with Neff and Heist for backseat advice. Eulipians, fine fellows, travelers together, taking a break from their fight, above the glow of the city at night, and even it will call us back later, and Charon will empty our mouths of the obols in pavement, for whatever is left after Rassan has played a last serenade for our crossing. But for now, we will drive and talk trash, lay our hot backs on the warm-scented sand, laugh at the fates and howl at the stars. This is how beautiful friendships start. Fiction rewritten from the inside out.
Well, how did you do with those hidden references?
I have to be honest with you, I think I got two of them.
Not many more. That's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour, folks. Keith Tyler here saying thank you so much for joining me, and tune in again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.